Oh, this is going to hurt, Lauren.
I'm Jerry Minocal.
Hi, Jerry.
We had an issue with a speaker. You know, life goes on, and we had a speaker take a face dive off a horse. And the horse is doing well. The speaker is doing well. The speaker was going to speak tonight, and she underwent some surgery. And so we're down a speaker. So we're trying everything we can to get a speaker to fill in. And last week, Lauren's working his way out the door. I said, Lauren, when's the last time you spoke here? It's about how it was, right? And I know perfectly well that Lauren would say, it's been a while, and yes, I never say no. And I've known Lauren for, I don't know how many years. It's been a bit. We met in a different fellowship up in Alpharetta. It was interesting. It was a very, very small meeting. And then I would see him around. I used to sponsor your sponsor, your old sponsor. And then I was his sponsor for a while. And so we've been friends and acquaintances for a long time. And he's active in the program, very active in the program. And we're glad to have him here tonight. Give it to Lauren.
Thank you, Jerry. Thanks for that introduction. My name is Lauren Kirby. I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Lauren. Hi, Lauren.
My sobriety date is June the 10th, 2007. I can't even get through saying my sobriety date without getting choked up. I have a lot of passion for this program. And hopefully some of that will come through tonight as I tell my story. Before I go too far, I want to call attention to my attire tonight. I received an email today saying to wear appropriate attire. And I don't have a whole lot of dress clothes. So I went looking through my closet, and I found this great outfit. Looks real flash on me. It's completely black, black necktie, matching black socks with this nice brocade. And I thought, that's what I'll wear. And about an hour before it was time to go get ready, I thought, oh no, I can't go to the meeting wearing black. This isn't supposed to be like a funeral dirge. It's supposed to be fun. If people didn't think this program, if people didn't think that there was fun in sobriety, who would want it, right? So I'm standing there at the closet, and I pick up this shirt to get it out of the way so I can see the other shirts. And I'm flipping through these Oxford shirts and going, okay, which one do I want to wear tonight? And I'm looking at this shirt and I go, holy smokes, the answer's right there in my hand. So that's why I'm wearing this shirt, okay? So I know that the respectful thing to have done would have been to wear an Oxford shirt with the tight collar and the necktie, and I didn't do that tonight because this shirt's fun. So I wanted to get that out of the way right away. There's also another thing that I'd like to talk about before I start my story, and this is a little bit of a segue, but you'll understand later how this ties in. I have a friend whose birthday it is today. He turned 42. And one of the things that I do every morning, if you're on my Facebook, if you're on my Facebook and your birthday is a public detail about yourself, you're going to find that I send out birthday greetings every morning to the people I'm close with on Facebook. So I sent him a birthday greeting on Facebook, and then I texted him, happy birthday. And he texted back, hey you, I hope you're smiling. And as those of you who know me know about me, I can be a little moody at times. And, you know, it's not always, every day isn't always perfect with me. I do the best I can. And the reason I bring this up about my friend's birthday is that back in May, this particular friend was diagnosed with an extremely rare form of lymphoma. And when he came to me and was telling me that he'd been diagnosed with this disease, I literally just fell apart. I wear my emotions on my sleeve anyway, and I was in tears. And I said to him, what can I do to help? And he said, what I need from you is for you to be strong. And I said, look at me, I'm a mess. You're the strong one. And the reason I bring all that up is if I was to go to my friend right now and say, I got these 12 things. If you just do these 12 things, 12 simple things, the lymphoma will go into remission, and you don't have to die from this. You know what he'd say? He'd say, when can we start? That's what he would say. Okay? The day before I got that news, I got a text message from a guy I'd been sponsoring for about 3 months, and he said, I don't want to do the step work anymore. I don't want to be addicted to recovering from addiction. I don't want to be addicted to fighting addiction. Or words to that effect. I'm misquoting it slightly, but I can't remember the exact words. And it doesn't matter, you get the message. So, you know, the very next day I get this horrible news from my friend. And, you know, I thought about that for a long time. You know, what had I done wrong in sponsoring this guy? How could I have helped him better? What could I have done differently that would have made him want this more? And what I came to was that he hadn't been beaten up enough. He hadn't had enough pain in his life to get to a point where he was ready to do the work. It wasn't me. There may have been some things I did wrong. I'm not saying that. But it wasn't me. It was that he didn't want it enough. Okay? He didn't see the connection between him being able to live his life and that next drink or bump or whatever, right? He couldn't see that if he continues down the path that he's on, he may be putting his life in jeopardy. There was a young woman who used to attend this meeting. I think she was about 22 when she passed away this spring. And, you know, when I think about the courage that her parents had as they were burying their daughter, and the pain that they were going through, and the grief that they were going through, and how from the pulpit in the church, they still carried the message of this program. You know, and I think about that, and I don't think I'm addicted or overly addicted to carrying this message. I think, what more could I be doing to help someone so that the next parents don't have to bury their daughter, right? So I just wanted to put all of that out there to give some context to my story. I wasn't an alcoholic when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in here in 2007, and I remember sitting in a little glass room in Ridgeview Institute, and this guy was asking me these questions. The only question that I can really clearly remember exactly was, he said, would you like a sandwich? And I was starving, and I said, yes. And they went and got me a sandwich. But he was asking me questions like, have you ever blacked out? Have you ever driven when you knew you were too drunk to drive? Yeah, so who doesn't, right? You know, he was asking me all of these qualifying questions to try and find out if I was a real alcoholic and if they should admit me into Ridgeview and put me in treatment there. And apparently, even though I answered most of his questions no, they saw through me and they threw a net over me and they put me in there. Initially, I was supposed to be in the outpatient intensive IOP program. And about 2 or 3 hours into that, they told me to go home, pack a bag, and come straight back. And I was there for 28 days. And it didn't stick. I got out of treatment, and I did what all good alcoholics and drug addicts do. I thought I had this thing, and I did what I like to call off-the-wall recovery. Does anyone know what off-the-wall recovery is? Jerry's nodding his head. In most AA meetings, they put these big banners up on the wall that have the steps listed out there, right? And they'll have another one over on the other side of the room that has the 12 traditions listed out. So without listening to a word of anything that anybody was saying in the meeting, I'd sit there in the meetings and I'd read those 12 steps and I'd work the steps in my head during the meeting. And I never actually did any real step work. And I got off-the-wall recovery, which after 87 days of that, I was as dry as well-cured firewood, and the first opportunity I had to drink, I was back out there. Okay? That doesn't have to be your story. It was my story, but it doesn't have to be yours. So my drinking career started when I think I was about 13 or 14 years old. May have been a little earlier than that. My parents had had a party, and neither of them were beer drinkers at all. In fact, neither of them were heavy drinkers at all. My mother abuses alcohol. She'll have a glass of wine, and about halfway through it, she'll say, "You know, I'm starting to feel this. I better go lay down." Which is, of course, alcohol abuse, right? So there was this case of Miller Lite. Actually, at that time, they called it light beer from Miller. And it was a white can with a little Miller crest on the side of it. And it said light, misspelled, L-I-T-E, on the side of it. And they had put that in the bottom of the refrigerator, I guess expecting that it would sit there until the next time they had a party or until someone came over who drank beer, because no one in our family drank beer. And so I would go and I would sneak one at a time, and I'd have just one, because I knew if I like got a bunch of them, I'd get caught. Well, eventually they were all gone, so. But I think my brother got blamed for it. He was 5 years older than me. I'm not going to talk too much about my drinking and using, because that's not really what I'm here to do tonight. I want to give you enough that you can, that I can qualify myself to you as a real alcoholic and a real addict, but we don't need to have a long drunkologue. I was the kid who was always shutting down the party, because I'd be, you know, when I was 14, 15, 16 years old, I'd go to these keg parties with my older brother. And, you know, I loved the ones where they had the pump keg instead of the one that had the taps at the bottom. Because with the pump keg, you could take that tube and you could stand there and just hold it like this and have somebody pump it for you. And you could get a good belly full of beer in a matter of a few seconds. And so what I mean by shutting down the party is I would do that, and then one of two things would happen. Either I'd get sick and I'd go pass out in the bathroom, or I'd need to pee, and I'd go pass out in the bathroom. And of course, since the bathroom door was locked, and these were these little two-bedroom bungalows with one bathroom, when somebody's locked themselves in the bathroom and then passed out, the party moves to a different house, because it's not very long before someone else needs to use the bathroom. So that happened more than once. Fast forwarding to my early 20s, you know, by then, drugs are a part of my story, but I'm going to try and avoid talking too much about that. In my early 20s, I realized that when I drank, I didn't really enjoy the experience of drinking, because if I drank an amount that I could keep under control, it wasn't fun for me. I needed to go home and do something else to feel right. And if I drank the way I really wanted to drink, I lost all control and I ended up way too drunk. So in my early 20s, I started doing this where I, you know, if somebody would invite me to a party where there was going to be drinking, I would take my own and I would only drink what I brought, and then I'd leave and go home and do something else. Or if we were going out for drinks after work, I'd limit myself to two because I knew if I went beyond that, I wouldn't even be able to walk to the bus stop. So then, fast forwarding a little bit more, for about a very long time, what I discovered was that while I couldn't really control alcohol, and a lot of this, I realized from my behavior that I'd made these discoveries. A lot of this I didn't really consciously become aware of until I had a couple of years sober, and I looked back at the behavior and I went, well, you know, the reason I stopped drinking in my early 20s was I couldn't control it, right? And then, you know, fast forwarding to my mid-30s, by now I was, I'd moved back to Arizona. I grew up in Seattle, Washington. I lived there for about 29 years. Then I moved to Arizona for 5 years, and then I've been in Atlanta for 15 years. So as you can tell from that, I'm a lot older than I actually look. But we moved to Arizona, and my drinking picked up a little bit, but not that much. I was, at that point, firmly entrenched in what I like to call the marijuana maintenance program, because I could control that. I could not do anything until 6 p.m., and then do just what I needed to feel right, and then go to sleep and have some nice dreams and wake up and do it all again the next day. And that worked really well. For a very long time, that worked really well. Then I got to Atlanta, and I didn't know anybody in Atlanta. And about a year after I'd been here, this very nice neighbor of mine at my apartment complex invited me in for a drink. And I thought, wow, that sounds good. I think I'll do that. And this guy was into small batch bourbon. Anybody know what small batch bourbon is? I see a few heads nodding. So there's the bourbon that's on the top shelf, and that's where I would always start a binge. Those bottles cost anywhere between $50 and $150 for a liter of bourbon. And then there's Evan Williams down here on the bottom shelf, and that costs about $15 for a handle jug that's like a liter and a half. Okay? So you get the difference there? So we'd start on the top shelf, and by the end of the weekend, we're drinking the Evan Williams out of the jug. But it took me a while to get to that point. When I first started going over and hanging out with this guy, I was very impressed with how much he was able to drink. He could take a 20-ounce tumbler and pour, you know, about that much Jack Daniels in the bottom of it, throw a few ice cubes in it, fill it the rest of the way up with Coke, and he could drink three or four of those in an evening. And he'd fix one like that for me, and I'd get through one, and I was plastered and ready to go home and sleep. But very quickly it started to progress, and I started really, really liking it. And I got to a point where I never really was sobering up. I was always, as the book says, more or less insanely drunk. And one of my coworkers, at the time I was teaching these technical classes at work, and I had a co-facilitator who we were teaching these classes with, and one morning she approached me and she said, "Do I smell alcohol on you? Have you been drinking?" And I said, "No." And I was telling the truth. I hadn't been drinking. It was from the night before. I just hadn't sobered up from the night before, and I probably was sweating it out as well. So that person also had, the person who introduced me to small batch bourbon also had a love affair or a fondness for a certain powdered form of alcohol. And I had tried that back when I was a teenager, and at that time it was a lot more expensive than it is today. Most things have gone up in price because of inflation over the years. This particular substance has come down dramatically in price. So when I first tried it, I spent $100 for a very small portion and used it by myself one night, and I was up all night, and I got to the, you know, point where the sunlight was coming up, and I thought, what the heck? I just wasted $100, and all it did was make my face numb. Well, it did a little bit more than that, but we won't talk about it here because of discretion and all of that. But basically, it just made my face numb. And so I was not happy about that. It kept me up all night and made my face numb. So I didn't do that again for a long, long time, because $100 just to have a numb face, I can pass on that. This friend of mine who introduced me to small batch bourbon also reintroduced me to that powdered form of alcohol, and something was different this time. Maybe it was the potency, maybe it was the combination of that and the bourbon. I have no idea, but something inside my brain woke up and it said, hello, what was that? We want a little bit more of that. Whatever that was, we want some. And at first it was no big deal. It was just once in a while on a weekend. And then the alcoholism began to progress, and I was at a point where on a Friday night, I would buy a bottle of top shelf bourbon with the intent for that to last a week or 10 days. And by Sunday, I was polishing off the last of it. And Monday, I was going back to the package store because I couldn't make it through the week until Friday without having some. At that same time, I had moved to another apartment complex, and met this person who was homeless, and never occurred to me why the person might have been homeless. But being the good-hearted drunk that I was, I figured, well, you know what? You can sleep on my sofa. Well, what this person brought with him was more of that powdered white stuff. And I didn't, at the time, really connect the consequences, but the consequences started to add up pretty fast, and within a few months, I was being evicted from that apartment. And so, since my finances were still in pretty good order at that time, I quickly found a house to buy and moved, and just basically started all over, but now I couldn't be evicted. Things progressed very rapidly at that point. And there's a passage here in the book. Let me see if I can find it quickly. It says, at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. So, about a year before I decided to come into the, to check myself into Ridgeview, this would have been probably January or February of 2006, someone who was helping me get what I needed asked me if I thought I could stop. And I said, yeah, I'm pretty sure I could. That if I just put it down, I could leave it alone. And by the middle of the summer, by about July, that young man who I'd taken in, who I hadn't really thought carefully about why he was homeless in the first place, had become a very dangerous factor in my life, and I knew that I couldn't stop as long as he was around, because the two of us were feeding off of each other. If he was trying to stay clean, I was trying to drink and get high. If he was trying to drink and get high, I was probably trying to stay clean. And we kept having knife fights, and things were starting to get really ugly. So I did something that was probably, bless you, probably not the kindest thing that I've ever done, but it got him out of my house. I'd tried several different things. I'd tried getting him to go stay with someone else. I'd tried taking him to the homeless shelter. He'd even gotten locked up in, bless you, he'd even gotten locked up in jail a couple of times, and nothing ever worked. What would happen is I'd go to work, I'd come home, he'd be back at my house. So, and of course, he knew all the different ways to break into the house, so there wasn't really any way to secure things and lock it down. So what I did was I told him that his mother had decided that she wanted him to come stay with her, and bought him a Greyhound bus ticket and gave him $10 of cash and put him on the Greyhound bus. And I stayed at the Greyhound station until the bus left to make sure he was on it and gone. So he called from Cincinnati, Ohio the next day, madder than a hornet's nest, because he'd called his grandmother's house, which is where his mother was staying, and asked to talk to his mother, and his grandmother had said, oh no, and hung up. They were not expecting him, and they were not happy that he was in Cincinnati. But he had no money, so he had no way to get back to Atlanta. And I thought that was going to work. I honestly believed that now, with him out of my life, I could stop drinking, I could stop using, everything was going to be fine. And I made it about 3 days. I had crossed that imaginary line from which there's no return. My Fitbit just went across the floor. There we go. And I had lost all power, all control over my using. So, not being the sort of person who likes to sit around all night doing this kind of thing alone, I started drinking and using with a different person. Let's just call this person my favorite using buddy. And that went on for another 6 months. At Christmas, I decided that I was going to go out to Arizona for the holidays, spend 16 days visiting with my mother and with my family out there, and that while I was out there, that would be it. That would be the separation. I wouldn't have anything to drink. I wouldn't do any substances. I would get clean, get my head clear, come back with a new outlook, and I'd be on top of the world. So I got off the airplane, and my mother needed to stop at Costco for something, and my sister was with us when my mother picked me up from the airport. While my mother was in Costco, my sister explained to me that she had scored something for me and that I needed to give her a check for $100. So that didn't really work out so good. So the 2 weeks of drying out in Arizona turned out to not be 2 weeks of drying out in Arizona. And another thing I'm not very proud of that happened at that time was that I taught that sister how to cook crack. She'd been smoking it for 20 years, but she didn't know how to cook it. And that really doesn't have much of anything to do with anything, but I got back to Atlanta, and about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from my mother saying that my sister had passed away. So I went back to Arizona for the funeral, and I came back to Atlanta after the funeral and started calling treatment centers and making appointments for evaluations and stayed as drunk and as high as I could until I checked myself in. My first sobriety date was January 31st, 2007. And as I said at the start of this story, I did off-the-wall sobriety. So I wasn't actually working steps. I had a book, which I hadn't read. Well, I'd read a few pages out of it, but I hadn't read very much of it. You notice this one is kind of in ragged condition, and my hope for you is that, first of all, that you have one of these. If you don't, get one. Also, if you don't, get with someone who has one that looks like this and have them take you through it, because the solution to this problem is in this book. That same person, favorite using buddy that we were talking about a few minutes ago, called me as I was leaving a 12-step meeting at Ridgeview Institute one evening, and he said, "Hey, would you like to get a couple of drinks?" And I said, "No, I can't do that. I'm sober now." And he said, "No, no, call your sponsor. It's okay." He said, "Remember that other stuff was your problem." And see, I left out a detail of my story that's very important here, and I need to put this detail in because it is really important. When I went to Ridgeview, when I was sitting in that little room being evaluated by that person to find out if I should be in treatment or not, I went there not because I wanted to stop for good and for all, not because I was an alcoholic, because remember, at that time I wasn't an alcoholic. I became an alcoholic after I came in here. But at that time I wasn't an alcoholic. The reason I had gone to Ridgeview in the first place is I was spending $400 a week. I wanted to get it down to an affordable amount. I wanted to be able to drop a fitty on Friday and be good until Sunday. You with me? So, when he said, "A couple of drinks won't hurt you," I was like Jim in the book. You know, it can't hurt me. I've had dinner tonight. I'm taking them on a full stomach with some lemonade, right? Because I didn't put bourbon in my milk. To me, that's just nasty. So, you know, it's a 30-minute drive from Ridgeview Institute to my house. I hung up the phone from talking to my friend, and I started driving home. And I drove past a whole lot of package stores on the way. But somehow that one right by my house, I ended up having to pull in there. And I was good. I got just a little bottle, you know, it was just enough for four cocktails, just the little 0.375 milliliter bottle, right? That can't hurt me on a full stomach. And I fixed myself a bourbon and lemonade, and that tasted pretty good. And it tasted like another, so I had another. And about halfway through that second one, I thought, "You know what would go really well with this?" And I was off to the races. And it was 6 weeks and about 35,000, or 3,500, not 35,000. About 6 weeks and another $3,500 before I was ready to come back in. And the exact details are unimportant, but I woke up one Sunday and my favorite using buddy was sitting there on the couch. I slept on my couch. My couch reclines, right? So I slept on my couch because you couldn't get to the bed because the bed was piled with magazines and books and playing cards and broken crack pipes and all kinds of unimaginable things. You couldn't sleep in the bed because it was piled with stuff. So I slept on my couch because you could recline the couch and sleep on it. So we woke up and I said, you know, you kissed me last night. He said, yeah, I know. Would you drive me home? And for some reason, that just caused this whole picture to snap into focus. It was that moment of clarity that people talk about. This stuff's been going on for 3 or 4 years now, and nothing's gotten different. Nothing's gotten better. Things have gotten worse. People have died. I don't feel nearly as good today as I did 4 years ago. But nothing's going to change until I do something. This is not going to ever end well. It may end with me dying, but it's not going to ever end well. So we got in the car. I drove him home. On the way back, I got on my phone and I called my sponsor and I said, what do I do? And he said, and in fact, it's funny, we were talking about this gentleman earlier this evening. He said, go to this meeting on Friday night. Find this particular guy. Find out when and where that guy's book study is, and go to that man's book study. And he said, do everything that that man tells you to do. And at that point, 51% of me wanted to stay sober, and 49% of me wanted another drink and another bump. Anybody connect with that? Because I was not, you know, in the book, they talk about all the different things that people say. Well, you'd think he could quit for her, or, you know, the doctor told him that if he ever drinks again, he's going to die, but there he is all lit up again. I wasn't the kind of person who could just not drink and go to a meeting. I wasn't the kind of person who could just not smoke crack all night and get to work on time, okay? That wasn't me. You put a little bit of something in me, and that whole part of my brain that deals with addiction lights up, and as Jerry knows, I've only told you the tip of the iceberg of the kinds of things I like to get into. So there's a whole lot of addictive behavior that starts to emerge as soon as the slightest amount of mind-altering... yeah. Big. Lots. Okay? So that Friday, I got in the car and I drove to this meeting, and what an intimidating meeting. It was in a room about 4 times the size of this room, and there were about 150 or 200 people there, and I didn't know hardly any of them. And finding this guy that my sponsor had told me to find was going to be like looking for a needle in a haystack. And I heard somebody say a name, and it sounded like the name, so I followed that guy, and I said, hey, are you this guy? And he said, no, that guy's not here this week. But he'll be back next week. So I went back the following Friday, and this time I spotted him, and I found him, and I walked up to him after the meeting, and I said, my sponsor wanted me to ask you about your big book study. And he goes, well, you're in luck. We're starting at the blank page on Monday. Now, what are the odds? You know, if you read a chapter a week, what are the odds? So I showed up on Monday at 8 o'clock, and I did that for over a year. We went through the book a couple of times during that year, and every time we came to a step, we worked the step. And my experience with the steps was that at step 5, the obsession to drink and to use was lifted, and it hasn't ever come back. For other people, that may not be the case. Different people have different experiences with the steps, but that was my experience. At step 5, the obsession was lifted. So So we worked through the rest of the steps. I was confused for a long time about 10, 11, and 12. I won't deny it. I made a common mistake. I'll point out my mistake, and maybe it'll help someone else. On page 85. So everyone in here has probably read at least some of this book, right? Am I mistaken about that? Okay. So on page 84, it talks about step 10, and this is the most self-explanatory step in the whole book. It's clear-cut direction. All you have to do is read the paragraph and do what it says. It says, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So what it's asking me to do is start working this step as soon as I start working step 9. I don't wait until I'm done with step 9. I start step 10 right away. We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. So how long do I work step 10? Until my heart stops beating, right? I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Those are the things that we captured in our fourth step. So we're talking about doing a new fourth step on a daily basis. As things happen. See, I'm the kind of person who has 20/20 hindsight. I know when I'm about to do something wrong about 10 minutes after I did it. Okay? Anybody else? Right?
Oh, yes.
Okay. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. So, I mean, that's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, right? So we're doing 4 through 9 in a condensed form. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. So the analogy I use for this step when I'm leading my book studies is, let's say you were out doing some yard work and the hedge trimmer slips and you cut your leg. You're bleeding out pretty bad. How many people in this room are going to wait until 10 o'clock at night to go get a tourniquet on that thing? Right? You're going to wait until 10 o'clock, or are you going to get the bleeding stopped right now? Right? Step 10 is first aid for the soul. Put a tourniquet on that thing. Stop the bleeding. Right? The part that I missed, and I think a lot of people miss this, is at the bottom of page 85. So 84 and 85, we've been talking about which step? Step 10, right? And the typesetter caused some confusion here for people, because at the bottom of 85 it says, step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on the matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. So, from 86 on, what step am I talking about? No. That's the mistake I made. Bottom of page 85, it said step 11. We're not talking about 10 anymore. We're talking about 11. So when it says, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day, what step are we talking about? And it 11. And it took me a long, long time. It took me 5 or 6 years of being in this program and doing this work to understand why these steps were written the way they were written. And it was this gentleman right here who helped me to understand that. We have to take a nightly inventory in order to know what the defects are that we're trying to work on in our morning meditation the next day. If I haven't done a nightly inventory, I don't have what I need in order to be able to look at the next 24 hours in the morning half of step 11. So the reason step 11 is topsy-turvy, the reason they wrote it upside down the way they did, is I have to know what I need to work on before I can work on it. So I take a look at my day and I say, was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do I owe an apology? Have I kept something to myself which should be discussed with another person at once? Was I kind and loving toward all? What could I have done better? Was I thinking of myself most of the time? Or was I thinking of what I could do for others? Of what I could pack in the stream of life? By taking that inventory, now I have the self-knowledge to be able to look at my day the next day and say, okay, what do I need to work on? What good am I going to bring to the world today? Okay? On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. Okay? I was confused about those steps for a long, long time. And step 12 is important enough that they gave it a whole chapter all to itself. But step 12 isn't just about working with others. Let me read the step as it's written, because this is another one that I was confused about for a very long time. Step 12 is broken into three parts. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So the first part of step 12 is I have to work the other 11. I can't start step 12 until I've had that spiritual awakening. I have to have that as the basis of doing this work. Now, that's not to say that I can't be of service. I can pick up chairs, I can empty ashtrays, I can make coffee, I can help another person find a meeting. I can do all of those things. But until I've actually had the spiritual awakening as a result of working the steps, I don't have anything to carry to another alcoholic or addict in terms of taking them through the steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics. So that's chapter 7. That's taking the next guy through the work. And I try to do that as much as I possibly can. I have two guys that I'm working with right now taking through steps. And I've lost count over the years of how many guys I've tried to take through the steps. Some of them have made it all the way through, some of them have not. And then the third part, and this is very important, this is the part of step 12 that's often overlooked, it says, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So it's not just important to do these things when I'm here in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in front of you guys where I've got the love and support of other recovering alcoholics and addicts. It's just as important the other 23 hours of the day when I'm out there in the world interacting with people who don't have this program. I'd like to close with one last thought, because this is another thing. I read this in the book time and time again, and it wasn't until about 6 months or so ago. There's a big book study that I lead on Tuesday nights at a recovery residence. And I was taking the folks through this book, through this chapter, and it's been highlighted in my book for I don't know how long, probably at least 5 years that this sentence has been highlighted in my book. And, you know, when I first came in, I was sitting in a meeting of AA. I'm going to tell a little segue and then I'll get back to this. I was sitting in a meeting of AA, and I don't even remember the woman's name. She had this flaming red hair and a personality that would fill the room. And she said, you know, every time I open my big book, it has rewritten itself.
What did you say?
It has rewritten itself. There are things in that book that weren't there yesterday. I swear they weren't there, but they were. And this is one of those things that the book rewrote itself while it was closed. And I had this highlighted all along. It says, now, keep in mind my motivation when I first came in. I wasn't looking to get sober. I just wanted to stop spending $400 a week. And when I picked up this book and started working steps in earnest, all I wanted was to stop drinking and using. Okay? So when I fully connected with this, it was like a brick between the eyes. It was like, wow, that's heavy. It says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. So, I hope you've gotten something out of my story tonight that you were able to connect with. You know, the book says that we're supposed to talk about what we were like, what happened, and what it's like now. But the real purpose of an AA speaker meeting is for one alcoholic to be able to identify with another, for somebody to be able to say, yeah, maybe this can work for me too. Hopefully this message has touched someone in this room or someone who's going to listen to it later online, and hopefully somebody's going to get it and be able to say, yes, this can work for me. Thank you.